Batman and iVampire. Welcome to FW Team Up, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Siskoid.
And I'm Chris Franklin.
Taking you through a classic superhero team up, Batman and iVampire, from The Brave and the Bold, number 195, cover dated February 1983. And Chris, let me begin by wishing you some happy holidays. It's that time of the year, even though this is going to sound more like a Halloween episode.
Yeah. I remember I pitched this and I'm like, is this going to land somewhere around Halloween? You're like, yeah, it's actually going to be in early December. And I'm like, ah, nuts. Let's do it anyway. So happy holidays.
Yeah, I think maybe it was closer at one point, and then we had to skip a month because of my internet troubles during the summer.
That's true, yeah.
And then we pushed it back, so now it's a Christmas episode. But, you know, the Halloween spirit carries you through to Christmas.
Yes. I love both, but, you know, as you know, of course, but the House of Frankenstein, on as far as podcasting goes, is my brand. So yes, it definitely is. It's nice to kind of merge the two. So I appreciate this. I appreciate being able to do this.
Nature is dying. Halloween, and then Christmas is the light at the end of the tunnel. So as long as we haven't hit that date, like right now, the days are getting darker, the nights are getting longer. So it makes sense to do a vampire story at this point.
Yeah, there you go.
So let's preface with a reason or reasons why we like this guest character. What's so great about iVampire, about Andrew Bennett?
Well, I like him because he's essentially the Barnabas Collins of the DCU, the lead character, more or less, from Dark Shadows, the 1960s supernatural soap opera. I'm not sure if that's what J.M.D. Mateus was thinking when he created him, but he's a protagonist. He's even a heroic vampire back when those weren't a dime a dozen. So he's got a great look. His story's got a great hook. So there's a lot of potential there. And I just think he's kind of he's a really cool character, especially like dropped into the DCU.
Yeah, and I don't have a lot of experience with him. It's like I do admit to liking the New 52 series by Joshua Hale Falkov and Andrea Sorrentino. But I'm not a big vampire fan. I'll say that right away. It's like, I've always said that. It's like, I enjoyed the stories with vampires, but if you're asking, like, what's your favorite type of monster, it'll never be vampires for some reason. That's just not who I am. But in this case, I enjoyed this story quite a lot. We'll get into it. But first, we need to talk about iVampire's publication history. So I believe it's your turn to give us the rundown.
Glad to do it. In the waning days of anthology titles, DC was open to experimentation to boost sales. Weird War Tales got the Creature Commandos, also featuring a vampire named Velcro, of all things. And House of Mystery had iVampire. Both were created by J.M.D. Mateus, who had pitched the series as Greenberg the Vampire. But editor Len Wein thought iVampire had a better ring to it, and in my opinion, he was right. DeMatteis used the title Greenberg the Vampire for another vampire project later at Epic Comics. Debuting in House of Mystery number 290, March 1981, with art by Tom Sutton, the series starred Lord Andrew Bennett, a just nobleman who was a great warrior but took no pleasure in killing. On a nightly ride, he succumbed to a vampire's bite and was convinced by his lady love Mary that she should join him for his eternal life. Unfortunately, unlike Andrew, Mary was corrupted by her vampiric powers, and she set about creating a society to bring about the downfall of man and the rise of the undead. Andrew, who only partook of animal or bottled blood, vowed to stop and destroyed Mary, Queen of Blood, and her cult, the Blood Red Moon. Lots of blood in the names of these things. Their battle waged across the centuries to the early 1980s, where Bennett was joined by human ally and love interest Deborah Dancer and a Russian man named Mishkin, whom Bennett had saved from Mary as a child. Their war finally came to an end in Russia, with Bennett destroyed by an experimental drug meant to give humans vampiric powers with no weaknesses. The formula worked on Deborah, who finally dispatched Mary, letting Andrew's soul free. The series ran sporadically from House of Mystery 290 through 319, August 1983. DeMatteis was followed on writing chores first by Bruce Jones, then Dan Mishkin and Gary Cohn. Sutton dropped in and out on the art chores with Ernie Colon and Paris Cullins among those who provided art. covers were supplied by Joe Kubert and Michael Kaluta, so they were, of course, gorgeous. Other than this issue of Brave and the Bold, the series and characters never crossed over into the DC universe, although Andrew Bennett did get a Who's Who entry. DeMatteis brought a post-crisis Andrew Bennett into his late 80s Dr. Fate series, and the series was revived, as Siskoid pointed out, in the New 52, in that giant glut of 52 titles when that initiative began. It lasted 19 issues, crossing over with Justice League Dark.
Had more success than a lot of those series.
Yeah, it did.
It went more than a year and a half. And it was like this big sprawling story that, if there was a problem with it, is that it's like it was a never-ending story, you know, like decompressed, you know, the war between the two. Did they ever call her Bloody Mary? Because that seems, it would have been natural, right?
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't. I noticed through all my research, I never saw her called that. In my head, I thought that's what she was called, like just mm-hmm. referencing it back. But then when I read and I reread some of the House of Mystery stories, I'm just like, no, they never do call that. That's a missed opportunity.
Yeah, maybe there was a problem with it. Maybe it's a little too gory.
I don't know. They could tie her into the legend of, you know, saying it in the mirror and she appears or something, you know?
Yeah, I mean, no. Yeah. So this issue, now to the synopsis, Night of Blood. It's written by Mike W. Barr with art by Jim Aparo. Andrew Bennett, vampire, has come to Gotham City where police deny vampire killings. But he knows the truth. He stalks Gotham Park, where young lovers walk home at night. And when a sinister old man crosses their path, he pounces in order to save the man from the young vampires. They have been warned of his possible interference, confirming certain suspicions, and they are armed with guns that fire silver bullets. But Bennett is older and wiser. He manages to destroy them before flying into the night with a clue in hand. Cut to the Hodges residence, where a young woman is dying of a vampire bite.
I answered Hodges' summons because his daughter was the only survivor of the so-called vampire epidemic plaguing Gotham. Hodges agreed to turn over all evidence on his associate John Gunnarsson, a.k.a. Johnny the Gun, in exchange for my help in saving his ailing daughter. I agreed to the terms, but as I leave, Hodges' nurse makes a phone call. Unbeknownst to us, it was to Gunnarsson himself. Well, it was known to me because I'm always two steps ahead of everyone. I met the recently reinstalled Commissioner Gordon at the morgue and insulted his staff's abilities. While I looked over photographs of all the vampire victims, I noticed something rather curious about the photos of the bite marks. I welcomed Jim back by rudely leaving while his back was turned, per our usual routine.
On that night, Bennett visits Club Dracula, where a patron, dressed in Halloween clothes, tries to bite him with false teeth. He has no patience for these tourists who worship a curse they do not understand. But he senses real vampires here, too.
I arrived at Club Dracula and put on one of my patented rubber mask over cowl disguises to blend in with the crowd. The marks left on Hodges' daughter's neck were far too straight, unlike real teeth, and therefore were made by fake fangs from a fake vampire. Unfortunately, I had been ratted out by someone, so a group of goons in Gunnarsson's employ tried to grab me. They managed to rip off my rubber mask, but I paid them back with bruises.
At the same time, Bennett is accosted by his prey's vampire operatives, so he fights back.
I flipped away from the thugs, knocked into a fake Dracula, making him drop his fangs, and then found myself face to face with real vampires. But in my line of work, I've encountered some strange things, and I came prepared with a cross to repel them. But one didn't shrink away. It stopped to convince me we were working toward the same goal. He told me his name was Andrew Bennett, and that he was out to stop the vampire plague in Gotham, started by his one-time love and now sworn enemy, Mary, leader of the Blood Red Moon. I could sense Bennett's sincerity and took him at his word. Hodges had sent a man to keep an eye on me, and I told him to take the fake Dracula fangs to Dr. Weems to check the saliva for a kind of rare blood virus. I surmised the fake Dracula bit Hodges' daughter with the fangs and passed along his ailment to her. I also warned him about the nurse. Told you I was two steps ahead of everyone. Bennett and I swung and flew to Gunnarsson's penthouse apartment, and we found what I had also suspected. Gunnarsson was in league with Bennett's Mary. Bennett went after her while I encountered Gunnarsson, who had willingly joined the ranks of the undead. He brandished a gun loaded with silver bullets at me and opened fire. I dodged his blast and picked up some wooden debris from his shooting spree. I plunged it into his heart, but before he succumbed to his final death, he grabbed me by the front of my cape and pointed the gun straight at me.
Meanwhile, Andrew Bennett faces his corrupted wife, Mary, who he has pledged to destroy. She reels from his blow, but as he takes a vial of holy water out, he hears a scream. Batman's? Mary chooses that moment to escape. Bennett doesn't notice as he's racing into the next room, where Gunnarsson has Batman under his gun. He moves in. Batman tries to warn him. The bullets are... bang! Silver. In the year of our Lord 1591, Andrew Bennett died. In the year 1982, he died again. Or did he?
Bennett awoke to the sight of Hodges and Dr. Weems staring at him. Weems had removed the silver bullets, and I provided the necessary blood transfusion. With his daughter on the mend, Hodges kept his word and promised to turn over a new leaf. For some reason, I was in a good mood and didn't run him in. Despite his injuries, Bennett was quick to leave and pursue Mary and her cult. I still had to convince Gordon to stake the bodies of the vampire victims, but I told Bennett if he needed help with the Blood Red Moon again, I'd be glad to give it. But I hope he doesn't ask, because I'm really too busy with Gotham to go globetrotting in some other title. With gratitude and just a bit of envy, I watched him fly off in bat form.
And he never did help him again. With the-
Yeah, I know. That's like, yeah, I'll be glad to help you. It's like, yeah, I was like, lose that number, you know.
Even though they, you know, it ends on a note of friendship.
Yeah,
it never really did connect again with that story. Quite a fun story. Maybe a little too much happening, but let's look at the cover first. The cover's actually pretty simple because there's no real background here.
Oh yeah, it's very simple but effective. You know, there's this color shift from darker to light red to give it some dimension, and this, you know, basically it's Batman and Bennett coming at each other, great dynamic poses for both of them. Even if the scene never appears in the story at all, they never even have that Marvel moment where they fight at first. So the closest they get is Batman pulling the cross at him. And I did buy this off the stands despite skipping the vampire storyline in Batman and Detective a few months prior to this. So I was a wiener.
And composition, you've got like the cape and the coat are doing like the same motion, like a mirror effect. So you got your two bats, you know.
Yes.
It works quite well. But interiors, Gotham is perfect for a vampire story, right? You know, they've always got those red skies. Pre-crisis red skies during the night, a sort of smog effect. It's perfect for putting you in the mood for such a story. Anything like that first vampire encounter that Bennett has, they're really pulling a Buffy.
Yeah.
As Buffy was famous for... I think the movie does that too, or slightly differently than the show. The whole idea is to have, you know, you get your perky cheerleader walking home or whatever it is. In the movie, you think the cheerleader is going to get bit at the beginning of a, you know, vampire movie. Makes sense. But she fights back and you realize, oh, wait, this is a twist on the formula. Mm-hmm. In the show, they don't have Sarah Michelle Gellar do it. They've got another girl do it. And it turns out she's the vampire.
Yeah.
Twist. So this is a precursor to all of that.
Yeah, and I mean, even the fact that, you know, you stake a vampire and they just turn to dust, you know, that's a Buffy thing too. So, you know, which I never really did like that, because the whole, I think Bennett kind of says that, you know, it's because she had been a vampire longer or something. There's some dialogue there that kind of maybe gives a hint of that. But, you know, the whole point of staking is that, it like people used to stake in real life, stake bodies into the, you know, their coffin, into the ground, to keep them from rising as a vampire. It's literally like putting something through somebody so they won't get up. I mean, that's so I always like it. You know, you put a stake in them and like as long as the stake's in there, they can't move. But if you remove it, they get back up. So that's the vampire rule I kind of like. So I don't like the stake equals dusting kind of thing. But, you know, it's the rule here. So we'll go with it. So.
Yeah, and I mean, Bennett is using their own weapons against them.
Yeah.
You know, like he's shifting around so that like the guy gets shot with the silver bullet, and then the guy's own stake is used on the girl. They don't make it too gory. So, you know, you see it poking through, not through, but poking into the coat on the other side of her body, but you don't see the gore or anything like that. So it's tastefully done, but I think there are good action moments. Like, right away, Bennett is an action hero on the same level as Batman.
Yeah, it's a great way to establish, okay, there's good vampires, and there's a good vampire, and then there's bad vampires. So if you just you've never read Eye Vampire, which I didn't as a kid. I remember seeing it on the racks, but I didn't buy the horror comics back then. I was, like I said, I was a wiener. Mm-hmm. It's a great introduction in this superhero story to show good vampire, bad vampires. So
and there's going to be a turn as well when Batman meets Bennett that shows him that he can trust them as well. But let's get into that Batman story, because I think that's the... I want to call it a weakness of this story, but I'm not sure. There's a mystery here that is somewhat unconnected to the main story of Bloody Mary. Bloody Mary's like converting vampires left and right in Gotham. That's one thing. That's one strand. But then the girl who is suffering... The mobster's daughter, who is sick in a coma with a vampire bite, that's completely unconnected, really, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I was having trouble following it.
Yeah, it's kind of an odd swerve, because there was some reason that she had just not, like, been drained all the way or something, you know, and... I mean, we've seen that in vampire stories before, obviously, you know, in Dracula, Lucy Westerna is a victim of Dracula repeatedly, and she just keeps getting worse and worse, and they give her transfusions, and she gets better, and then she gets worse, and I mean, you know, that's a trope in, like, the most famous vampire story. So, I mean, they could have went that route, so bar going with the fake vampire, just, like, having some kind of blood disease that he passed along to her is... The guy that, you know, Batman bumps into later, knocks the fangs out of his mouth, seems just like a goofball, you know. It's kind of weird to make him the, maybe they were just being kinky and he bit her, and obviously I don't think he meant to give her a blood disease, you know. I mean, so I don't think any criminal charges were probably brought against the guy, you know. So it's kind of an odd, and I had forgotten about that part. I just assumed in my brain, oh yeah, she's a victim of this vampire plague that Mary started in Gotham. Nope. The only connection is the vampires are basically, the real ones are hiding out at Club Dracula. That's the only real connection.
Right. That's where they meet, because their two cases converge. They don't converge. Converge would mean they're the one and the same. No, they intersect at the same place.
Yeah.
Which puts Batman on this secondary case for him. Yeah. Maybe a little too much going on.
Hodge's daughter is never even named, which I think's, you know, it's like talking about being a victim. They never even give her a... They never give her a first name, you know. It's just, my daughter, you know. It's like, well, you could have just, like, simply dropped her name. Her name's Linda or something, you know.
This is not the second issue in a row for the series, but for us, it's the second issue we cover in a row where Batman is forced to help the bad guys, like mobsters.
That's right.
He's helping because, I mean, this poor girl, more or less an innocent, born in the wrong family, but... you know, he's walking into that house. He's been invited there, you know, but people are pulling guns out and he's squeezing their arms. And it's like, it's a very hostile, I'm going to help you, but I'm going to hurt half your guys doing it.
It reminds me a lot of the early Batman animated series where there were a lot of gangster storylines, you know, and Batman would come in and have to converse with one of the gangsters while his thugs, you know, just out of habit, basically tried to muscle in on him, and, you know, Batman show him up and make him look bad. Yeah, so, of course, this came first.
I guess the other connection is Gunnarsson, Johnny the Gun.
Yeah.
He's got a beef against this mobster, and it turns out he's one of the converted vampires.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's another connection there. But Gunnarsson was guiltless of this particular crime. No worries, he'll commit plenty more.
Yeah, right.
Barr is really doing, like, the, you know, fair play mystery type stuff. Him and Aparo are not over explaining things. You know, you got Batman is looking at pictures. As a reader, you can go in there and say, oh yeah, it's not exactly the same bite marks as we saw on the girl's neck, or you can come to some of your own conclusions, you know, but they don't necessarily say everything in the dialogue.
No, I mean, you know, you kind of got to go back and look at the panels to see the teeth mark impressions and see if, you know, it's like, oh yeah, they're really perfect. Like, you know, just like a pair of fake Halloween vampire fangs. And although, you know, sometimes people do have perfect teeth because, you know, people go to the orthodontist and get their teeth straightened out. But I guess Batman figures a vampire is not going to go to the orthodontist. But what if they went to the orthodontist before they were a vampire? I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's early 80s. People had less perfect teeth back then.
That's true. That's true.
As we move into chapter 3, Club Dracula. This is one of those strange apparel perspectives where the street is super wide.
Yeah.
And you see Bennett, who could be Batman, you know, just like the cape. I guess it's his coat, like going in there. Or maybe it's just like a random vampire going in there because Bennett himself is not wearing any kind of cape. It's like he gets in there and he's kind of dressed as matches Malone here. You know, and he walks into this club of fakers, but real vampires go in there because there's a sign at the door, enter freely and of your own will. So that's an invitation.
Which is what Dracula says to Harker in the classic novel.
Yeah,
so that's great. That's a nice callback, yeah.
Especially if they're going to, you know, call themselves Club Dracula. But this is where Batman's going to get into a fight with goons, Bennett with vampires, and then they're going to switch partners, dancing partners in this. And that's how they recognize that. You know, like Bennett is on his side. It's like, well, these are up to my level, these goons, but they were going to hurt other people, you know, so I dispatched them quickly. I didn't suck their blood or anything. So Batman's convinced.
Right. Yeah. And I like that, of course, you know, Batman, like I mentioned, just a few months prior in the late summer, fall of 82, Batman had just been through Jerry Conway's retelling of his encounter with his first vampire foe, the Monk, in his own title and Detective. And Batman and Robin actually became vampires, or vampiri, as they call them, because they weren't dead. And they were saved via blood transfusion, much like Bennett, Batman does for Bennett at the end here. So that was what Batman was referencing. But I always like it. I hate, one of my absolute pet peeves in comics is when DC Universe or Marvel Universe characters are surprised by encountering a supernatural character after they've already encountered supernatural characters. You know, it's... Right. Batman has teamed up with the JSA and the freaking Spectre is on the JSA. You know, it's like, you know, the Phantom Stranger. You know, it's like, this point, just accept there are supernatural creatures and supernatural forces. Batman doesn't flinch. He came prepared. He knows he's dealing with vampires. He brought a cross with him. He's probably got a vial of holy water in one of his utility belt capsules. And I like that. I like to say, what, vampires are real? Yeah, of course they're real, dude. You met one like... How many times have you met one in this continuity, you know?
Yeah, I don't know, he's friends with Deadman, you know?
Exactly.
So it makes sense, especially if there was like a storyline recently and Mike Barr would have been aware of it. And he's having a lot of fun in this because, again, we get another fake out. You know, the Dracula-looking guy, Toxic Teeth, is a faker. And so you think you're seeing real vampires, you're not, etc. But also, just the dialogue... There's so many vampire puns in here. You know, it's like the mobster earlier says, all the mob stuff doesn't matter. This is blood because it's his daughter. So they do, like, he does that. I would prove my intentions to you, Batman, should our paths cross. And Batman's holding up a cross at this point.
Yeah.
The apartment later is guarded to the teeth. So there's a lot of, like, just wordplay.
Yeah.
That Barr puts in there, which adds to the fun, I think.
Yeah, I think Barr is maybe this is a kind of a stupid thing to say about a writer, but Barr is a very literate writer. He's very well read, you know, in all of his things. He references back to things. He's a huge fan of classic literature and of, you know, of Poe in particular. He's a big Poe fan. And so, I mean, you know, it doesn't surprise me that he's, you know, he's probably having a ball with this. It's like, ooh, I get to play with vampires, you know? So.
Yeah, I mean, after the Club Dracula scene, you know, you got Bennett kind of scaring the mobster's tail, who was following Batman. That's a fun bit. And then I think there's something really amusing about Bennett turns into a bat and they're going to the next place. And it's Batman talking to a bat. And it seems like, yeah, that's kind of a natural, like, you know, like imagine a world where Batman has a pet bat.
Yeah.
And he's always talking to, you know, it's like, you know, the Red Bee's Michael, the bee, or, you know, it's Aquaman talking to Tusky or...
Falcon and Red Wing or something, yeah. Surprised Hanna-Barbera never pitched the series where Batman had a pet bat. You know, it would have been a anthropomorphic, like, cute, scrappy-doo type bat, but still, you know, it's like...
Yeah. I think Robin... kind of saved him from that fate.
Yeah.
You're always going to put him with Robin. Robin is the character he's going to talk to. But imagine there's no Robin. You're talking to your pet bat.
Could have got a pet bat like Dr. Midnight had Hootie in the 40s, you know, or something. Yeah, it's... Yeah, it's a great visual too, though. I mean, I love the. Of course, it always in this era. It, you know, now that Batman, thanks to the 89 movie and then the animated series in particular, Batman having his constant grapple gun makes a lot more sense for him to be able to swing through the city than, you know, throwing a batarang with a bat rope on it and over. But it sure looks great. You know, I mean, it looks wonderful, and I love the coloring. You know, every time we bring up this era of comics, it's always a pleasure to see what is Adrian Roy was the colorist on this one, right? What she brought to the table, because they're in just cast just purely in yellow from the city lights up in the red skies, and it just looks great. I mean, you could just color them straight, but it's much more evocative to do that you know, more artful color treatment on them. And Adrian Roy is just. She is the unsung hero of Batman comics for like almost like 20 years. She colored almost every Batman comic book. She just doesn't get enough praise heaped on her.
The mood that you need to bring in a Batman story, right? So a lot of that comes through, I think, like the lower positions, you know, the inking, which is also a Perro here, of course, the coloring. That's where you're going to get, you know, from something that's a little more like a standard superhero story. And then how do you get that Gotham mood? Shadows and subdued colors and sort of those kinds of effects, you know. Those red skies or purplish skies, that's all her.
Yeah, and I think that's probably one reason why when they, you know, going back to my milieu, the animated series, when they went to the new Batman Adventures, the skies were almost always red.
Right.
And I think it's definitely, I think the influence of Adrian Roy and colorists like her definitely seep through to the animated series.
Oh, yeah. So we get to those final fights, and I'm taken by how much Perro is working within the Bronze Age limitations in terms of the violence, while still keeping it really dynamic. If you look at it, it's like, okay, Bennett has to punch his wife. That's not a great moment out of context, right? But right. The fist is not in shot. When you look at Batman staking Gunnarsson with a table leg, it's just the shadows of it. Yeah, I'm showing it, but I'm not really showing it, which is you know, a difficult balance to keep, especially in a vampire story, because the horror element is going to be violent.
Yeah, it's really super well done. I mean, I love that, you know, there's the you know, sound effect, which is Perro too, because he did the lettering as Batman stakes Gunnarsson. It's in silhouette, just in silhouette. And you're right. I mean, you know, Bennett's backhanding or punching Mary, we're not holding against him like Hank Pym. You know, it's like, oh, Andrew Bennett, he was a good character till he backhanded his wife. Of course, she's evil. So, I mean, you know, but still, yeah, they don't show him like, you know, she's in the foreground with this pained look on her face, and you see her fangs. But you can, like we've always, you know, everybody always says, and I think Rob was the first one brought it up on the network, that even off panel, Perro's, you know, atomic punch is evident, you know, that it really hurt, you know, so.
It made me be a little confused with Gunnarsson's fate. You know, I had like to look at the panels again. It's like, okay, wait, what's happening? Because he got staked, but he's still active and pushing Batman down. And then it's only like, oh, okay, I see. After he accidentally shoots Bennett, you see that his arm is holding on to Batman's cape, pulling it down. And there's like that pink dusting effect that we've seen. So
yeah, I think that it goes back to what was, you know, that panel of the female vampire disintegrating on contact. Apparently she'd been a vampire for a long time. And so if you're an older vampire, you were, of course, you stay the same age you were when you were vampirized. But if you're, you know, an ancient vampire, you should be like 100 years old, then you're going to turn to dust when you get staked. But if you're like Gunnarsson and you've just been a vampire for like a day or two, then yeah, it's going to take you a while to start smoking and then, you know, disintegrate. So I guess, so you have enough time to pull a gun on Batman and make him scream like a girl, you know, so.
Right. I think it tracks with what we saw in the park. She was older, but her boyfriend was newer. We don't see him dust. We see a pink spray around. They don't give him that money shot.
Right.
Bennett has the time to look through his pockets and find the Club Dracula matchbook. So it tracks with what we've seen before, even though they don't explicitly say it. Although the last panel on that page where Gunnarsson dies, it's like, okay, now this violence is too far. So Adrian Roy colors Bennett's blood blue. So it kind of looks like he's just resting into his own drool.
Well, I always kind of thought it was like, it almost looks like, to me, it's always like Batman says, Bennett, no, his bullets are silver in that panel. Almost looks like he's bleeding silver, like from the silver bullets or something. That's what it looked right. like. You know, it's kind of odd, you know, it's because he's, yeah, it's like, I guess it's the suggestion of silver and then seeing that. But yeah, it does look like he's just, like he fell asleep and is drooling really bad, yeah. I love the pained look on Bennett's face, though, in that panel where he gets shot. I mean, of course, they don't show it, but you hear bang, bang, you see bang, bang, and yag! Apparel can just bring the pain on his face, all the, you know, folds and lines, and then the coloring. Adrian Roy's got his darker shade of pink. I love the pink shade that they give Andrew Bennett. I guess that was a way in his own comic, too. He's got this kind of light pink skin, usually. Some panels he's colored almost same as Batman, but he's just got this pinkish skin and these yellow eyes and red irises, and it's just... he's got a great look, and this is, this panel, and his white streak of hair, it's just all very, this would be cool, like, odd, you know, art panel to have hanging on your wall or something, you know?
Speaking of art on the wall, page 19, gotta mention it.
Yeah.
Ragman is in, like, the Mary or whoever owns that apartment has a painting of Ragman, which is a fun little Easter egg because that would be the next team up.
Yeah.
Because it didn't say at the end, next month, Ragman, I don't think it says that, right? So instead we get, I don't know if they did this much. Is this like something that they did?
Yeah, during this period. Yeah, Aparo started doing this, I think, when, I don't know if it was when Len Wein was editor or, you know, before when Paul Levitz was editor. But during this late 70s, early 80s period, he would sneak in like a tease for who's the next guest star is. And in one issue, I know he showed Batman was going to team up with the Legion of Superheroes in the next issue, but he drew their cruiser or one of their spaceships that looked quite a bit like the Enterprise. And so some fans thought, is it going to be a Star Trek crossover with Batman or something?
Fun. Yeah. That's really amusing. So, okay, Bennett's not dead because he got a transfusion from Batman. And these are like questions that are running through my mind. It's like, okay, is this the same as feeding? Can vampires feed intravenously? I guess so, right? Is this like replenish your... Does the blood have to go into your stomach? Or is it about getting it back into your own system?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I really don't know. Like I said, it's very similar to the last issue that the Vampiri saga opens with Batman on a table getting a blood transfusion in the Batcave. And there's this other monk that has helped Batman and Alfred and Robin out. And so it's kind of like, you know, Batman took this trick from that. And, you know, it's like it works on... Now, it doesn't cure Bennett, obviously. I guess he's too far gone. But it's kind of odd that these, you know, that this happened so soon after the other story, just a few months. But yeah, it's like Batman's doing a lot of blood transfusions in this period.
With vampires specifically.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's kind of the issue, you know, like they leave on the note that we talked about earlier. But I want to go to the Brave and Bold mailbag, which has, I always look at these if I have the issue around because, you know, who wrote in? Like this one, like the first one is TM Maple, who was a letter hack from the time, right? You always saw his letters in letters columns all the time. But the one we want to bring attention to is a certain Mark Waid of Richmond, Virginia. So, yeah, Mark Waid, who was unhappy with the issue discussed. I hate to have to put it this way, but I've been with B&B for 20 years now, 20 years. And I must say that in all that time, there was never as bad a story as Who Killed Adam Strange. So I was incredibly disappointed by what looked to be such a good idea and with Infantino artwork that I couldn't read anything else for a long time. I just walked around the house muttering something to the effect of a planet of billions of people and Batman guesses who the murderer is. He guesses. Did you not stop to think how ludicrous that idea is, that he picks on some girl who tried to shoot him down, maybe because she was nervous about the great detective, but more probably because she could have honestly thought him to be another invader? Does it matter that she had absolutely, absolutely no apparent motive nor any connection with Adam whatsoever? Come on. a bad story isn't something to shoot for, but a great idea turned into a bad story is a crime. Think next time, you, Mr. Barr, write a mystery, and you, Mr. Giordano, edit one. I haven't been this let down by a comic in a long time, and I doubt seriously that I have ever seen another that so much deserved never to have seen the light of day. No answer from editorial.
And it's funny because Mark Waid comes across as just this totally affable guy. You know, he's like one of the most, you know, down to earth and just always seems very friendly. I've met him at cons before, very super friendly guy. And when you see an interview with him, he's very much, you know, I'm the fan that made it, you know, and of course he's one of the greatest comic writers in my opinion, definitely for superhero comics. It's very funny to hear him, like, you know, giving Mike Barr crap about writing mysteries when that's like Mike Barr's thing. You know, he's probably thinks of himself almost more of a mystery writer than like a superhero comic writer with Maze Agency and everything. And Dick Giordano, who would of course become his boss in a few years. That's hilarious.
But that's how you get your letter published, right? Because, like, I know that the few letters that I've gotten published, I've put on an act, you know, like I've put on outrage, or I've put on some sort of fanish behavior that was not really real.
Yeah.
Like I remember writing a glowing letter about Venom and the Amazing Spider-Man in those early days when he was just a villain. I was eating spiders and that. You know, you want your letter published. So, and in another one is like outrageous that Zatanna smoked weed in the Hellblazer. And
right, yeah.
Sure, I believed what I was saying, but also I was laying it on thick. Right. I think that's what he's doing here to get his letter published, you know.
Probably, yeah. Probably so. I can't imagine he really felt this strongly about that. Yeah, it's funny. But and just to plug, I know a lot of our listeners are, you know, they're around our age and, you know, they're a little jaded about modern comics. But if you're not reading Mark Waid's World's Finest and Superman, Batman and Superman World's Finest and World's Finest Teen Titans, you're missing out because those are great comics. They're my favorite comics that are out right now and I love them.
Yeah, Shazam is good too.
Shazam is good too. Yeah, I've been buying that too. It's good too. Anything Mark Waid's doing at DC, it's great. And, you know, it's just, I am even a lesser Mark Waid story is still better than almost any other superhero story out there. So, yeah, definitely check him out.
Yeah, I would agree that he's like, he's my favorite superhero writer. So in this case, yeah, he's going to. But at the same time, it speaks to what we just saw in this issue. Like the mystery is a little underdeveloped because you got to cater to that team up. Like you can do a full mystery in an issue, or you can do a team up. But I think when the two things are sort of at cross purposes sometimes.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because like we said, the whole, where did that come from? The whole, you know. Yeah, Hodge's daughter thing, and it's but you know, also, you know, Barr has to come up with a new story every month, and he's probably writing a few other things too. So, and this is back in an era when comic writers were, Barr was a fan that became a pro, so it's not like he was just like a jobber or something. But at the same time, the idea was more of the monthly production, you know,
right.
It had to come out, you know, it wasn't, and it was a continuing series. It wasn't, you weren't going to like, oh, I need you to rethink this because we're going to reboot it with a new issue, even though we're only like 8 issues in of a new series, you know, like issue number 1 or something. So it was just a different time for comics, and maybe everything doesn't quite hook up the way it should, but yeah, he's putting out a lot of material, so.
You make a good point, because like today's writers generally, oh, I've got an idea for a story and I'm going to spread it across 6 issues.
Yes.
8 issues. In the Bronze Age at this point, some writers are starting to do long form, but especially a team up book like this, it's one-offs. So you got to come up with a story A to Z every month for every book that you're writing, rather than, oh, I've got an idea and I'm going to like milk it for 6 to 8 months. You got to generate from premise to execution to the epilogue, you know, everything on a monthly. So it's a very different way of working.
I think, though, too, on the opposite side of that, though, a lot of times in long form comic writing nowadays, I think sometimes they stretch things out so long by the time you get to the end, they have lost parts of the threads and things don't connect up like they should either, because they literally dragged it out too long and they forgot Why did we start here? What, this had absolutely nothing to do with the resolution, you know? I mean, there's right. been plenty of, like, trade paperbacks where you read through a story arc and it's like, well, the first part, first, like, two or three issues of this were pointless. They had nothing to do with the ending, you know? So that happens, too, now in the opposite direction sometimes.
All right, who fared better? We always ask, how well does this fit each of the stories or atmospheres? Is this a Batman story, or is it more of an I, Vampire story? Because we do have Bennett narrating, and mm-hmm. it's his villain who brings vampires to Gotham. So would you agree that this is his story?
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree. Batman provided the setting and showed up. You know, maybe they should have ran this in House of Mystery to boost sales. Imagine a House of Mystery issue that guest starred Batman. I mean, that would have, like, you know, that would have probably been the spiked sales on that title and maybe saved it. Yeah. So.
Right. The question that we ask only on Brave and the Bold is, do they know Batman's secret identity? And you're the expert on this.
No, but he does know his blood type now.
All right. Cool moves. What is Batman's coolest move in this issue?
I think Batman taking the table leg shattered by Gunnarsson's bullets and then staking him with it. I mean, you know, Batman's been murdering vampires since 1939. So it's always cool. I mean, I read this comic first, but I always go back to the Skeeter story and Action Comics Annual number one, the John Byrne, Art Adams story where Batman, like, you know, stakes her in the next panel. She's up on this big stake pike, you know, and it's always cool when Batman's killing vampires.
I think you have the answer, but I will name a smaller moment, more of a detective cool, which is when he's in the morgue and you got all these nobody puts them in the refrigerator. The bodies are just, yeah. I guess the vampires are going through livestock as fast as possible. So they're all just on tables with shrouds over them. And Batman's looking through the pictures. A very cold look at those bite pictures throws him back. And as it turns out, he's basically solved the case. Like, we don't know. Like, later, he comes up with these conclusions that we're just like, where does this all come from? This is where he solves the case, on page 9.
Yes.
And he does it silently, and he doesn't tell Gordon anything. And it's like...
After he insulted people working for the police department, wouldn't pick up on what he did, which I think is kind of... You know, Barb was like the earliest... He was like an early adopter of not the completely unlikable Batman that we've got. You know, I know we're kind of getting away from that now in the comics, but... Mm. But you know, his Batman, you know, he was kind of a jerk in The Outsiders, you know, and...
Whenever I complain about The Outsiders, there are two problems for me. And one of them is Batman being such an a-hole to his own team.
Yeah. His Batman was like one of the first, like... You know, like, truly, like, kind of, like, you know, he was just kind of, like, so upset. He was, like, more obsessive than other Batman of the era. He was, like, the first, like, really obsessed Batman, to the point of being brusque with people. Although, I did always like that Barr had him be almost Adam West with Robin. I always liked that. He called him old chum, you know, things like that. So, it was a nice, you know, he was a well-rounded character. You know, he was kind of a jerk to other people, but with his family, he was, you know... It was like basically Adam West. So
yeah, Alfred, yeah. Robin, they get a pass, but everybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
Shut your pie hole, Metamorpho.
You don't know my secret identity.
Exactly. What about iVampire's coolest move?
I know it's standard vampire fare, but Aparo really drew Bennett's transformations into Bat and Wolf really well. I mean, it looks like a really cool power. Despite the whole Eternally Damned thing. And it really makes me wish, I know he worked on quite a few of the anthology stories, but it really makes me wish Aparo had a chance to draw a true horror series.
Mm.
I think it would have been great. So it's just, I love the way just the little, and it's Adrian Roy too, coming in with like the pink fades is, you know, as you know, he changes into the vampire and there's like the semi-silhouette of the bat, you know, as he morphs into it. And then from the bat to the wolf in the park scene, it's just really well done and just really cool. I mean, you can imagine it's very cinematic. You know, you just imagine it in a movie. It looks great.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's and into that park scene, for me, that's the coolest move. It's fighting those two vampires. A lot of action. It's two against one. I think that's his best moment. Well, let's ask, since it is supposed to be a debate. Bennett or Batman? who is the coolest in this issue?
I'm going to give it to Bennett because this made me a fan of the character. I had no exposure to him, and I've always kind of had a soft spot for him after this issue, just this one issue. And unfortunately, I was stupid and young and dumb, and I didn't start buying House of Mystery after reading this. I should have, and I might have saved it, you know, helped save it. But it made me, you know, when he showed up in, oh, cool, it's the, you know, in Who's Who, I'm like, oh, yeah, cool, I remember that guy, you know. And I've always kind of had a fondness for him. And I did eventually go back and read the House of Mystery story. So, yeah, I'm going to give it to him because this did the job. It sold me on the character and the concept.
All right. What about dumb or weird moves? Batman.
Well, I guess we shouldn't consider this a dumb move, and it should be considered a superpower at this point. But the rubber mask over the cowl thing, I know we talked about that a lot on the network, but it's like, I think the further you get along in the timeline up to modern comics, it seems sillier. They're still doing that. You know, he literally puts it over his ears, and Aparo drew Batman with pretty long ears too. So it's like, do the ears just like fold down underneath? You know, it's just funny that that a rubber mask could convince anybody that he's a real human, and two, that it would go over his cowl. So
yeah, no. And that was the one I had written down at first. And I thought, well, Chris is going to go for that. So so I'm questioning the scream at the end, although I can't quite parse whether it's Batman's or Gunnarsson's, because Gunnarsson gets staked. There's a scream, A-I-E, right? Yeah, and then there's another A-I-E later, or is it later? You know, did we go meanwhile and then catch up to that moment again, and Bennett hears a scream and he says, Batman? You know, disrupts his fight with Mary. So maybe it's not Batman screaming, but if it is Batman screaming, I think that's the lamest thing he does in this issue, if that's what happens.
Yeah, if he is, he's like Ned Flanders screaming, you know, when he screams like a woman, like high pitched. Yeah, it's basically like that. Yeah.
I'm not sure about the moment. So
me neither.
Let's call it weird more than dumb.
Okay.
What about Bennett's?
It's not really silly in the story, but Bennett puts on a modern coat and a cabby golf hat, you know, but otherwise he always dresses like it's the early 1800s. Even though he's from the 1500s, so why not change up your attire a bit? I mean, that's, you know, the tall boots and the white pants and, you know, the vest and, you know, the coat, the long coat, waistcoat. That's his look, you know, and it's like, yeah, you know, if you want to, like, not stick out so much, you might want to adopt modern clothing, you know, and he does to disguise himself, but then he takes it back off and puts his...
Well, he disguises himself in modern dress to go to Club Dracula, where everybody is in fancy 19th century dress.
Right. Yeah. He would have fit in more if he just kept his regular clothes on. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess he didn't want to be recognized by Bloody Mary and her people. So he's hiding the streak in his hair and that kind of stuff. I think for me, the lamest, dumbest moment is when he abandoned, like, he's got, of course, the story can't end there, but he's got Bloody Mary dead to rights. He's pulling out the holy water. He's going to dust her. And then he hears that scream and he runs away. And like she runs away in that moment, flies away. Can't you take like the 5 seconds to spray her with the water? At least to keep her there, you know, while you go check out if Batman's okay. So it's a little bit that moment. It's like, you're not obsessed enough, Andrew Bennett.
Right. Yeah.
So Bennett or Batman, who is the dumbest in this issue?
I'm going to give it to Bennett because of what you just said, because he could have ended his series right here. I know he can't end it in Brave and the Bold, but story-wise, yeah, he could have ended it right here. So,
yep, there you go. And finally, the friendly farewell. Let's see who won the social game. I mean, they basically leave as blood brothers. That's not pretty friendly.
Yeah, I mean, you don't get much friendlier than this. They shake hands and Batman is smiling. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if Batman's been this friendly with any of his Justice League teammates, you know. So, I mean, it's like he's going to invite Bennett over for dinner or something, you know. I don't know. It's like, you know, I'll have Alfred go to the blood bank, you know. I don't know. It's really super friendly.
We'll take a break for a couple of promos, and then we'll be back with our special features.
Just imagine the mightiest heroes of our time.
All of them on one team.
Since there are so many of us, we have a chance to do more than just put out fires. We can be proactive. We can do some real good in the world.
JLU Cast brings you coverage of Justice League Unlimited, the ultimate gathering of DC's heroes and villains, and the culmination of the greatest interpretation of the DC Universe ever.
Join Chris and Cindy Franklin as they relive the team-ups, the battles, the conspiracies.
I had no idea that the Girl Scouts were responsible for the crop circle phenomenon.
Few people do. Few even think to ask the question.
The romance and the fun.
A head start. You're getting soft in your old age.
Don't you have a tall building to go leap?
And the adventure continues.
Find us wherever fine Fire and Water podcasts are available.
Siskoid watches a lot of movies, like a lot. So now he has his own movie podcast, or several. Siskoid Cinema is your one-stop umbrella for a variety of shows like Fade In, exploring the first films of famous actors and directors.
This is a joke, right?
On Borrowed Time, discussing all your favorite time travel movies.
Whoa, this is heavy.
Why are things so heavy in the future? Is there a problem with the Earth's gravitational pull?
And No Escape from Kurt Russell, a dissection of the man, the mystique, and the movies.
There goes a perfectly good bumper sticker.
And more. Siskoid Cinema, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Coming soon from Amalgam Comics. On the Eastern European battlefields of World War II, Nick Bennett is killed by a vampire and reborn as the living undead. The only way to survive is for him to turn his entire squad into vampires themselves. Now every night, they bring guns and fangs to their fight with the Nazis in Nick Bennett and the Howling Bloodsuckers. On the stands every month, wherever Amalgam Comics are sold.
We're back. Our monthly feature, the bonus team-up, in which each of us proposes, in this case, a perfect I-Vampire team-up. What do you got?
So Bennett refers to Dracula as a romanticized fictional vampire, but I would like to see him confront the Marvel version of Count Dracula. Maybe Mary joins forces with Dracula and actually plays him, causing him and Bennett and Dracula's usual antagonists Frank Drake, Rachel Van Helsing, and Quincy Harker to join forces against her. So they're all working together against Mary. You could throw Blade in too for a quick fight with Bennett before they reach an understanding. I think that would be a really cool crossover.
Right, with Tomb of Dracula. I, Vampire, Eugene. So a British pulp spectacular where Andrew Bennett meets Lord Greystoke, Tarzan, and returns to the jungles of Africa with him to stop a local vampire from decimating the Lord of the Jungle's old stomping grounds. I think that gives us a chance to look at vampires in African culture. I had a book about this. Well, not about African culture vampires, but just about vampires across the world when I was a kid. I still have it somewhere, I think. And they pictured the African vamp as this giant mosquito or something, like a fly with a big bag of blood.
Ooh.
On its back. If I find it, I'll try to put it in the gallery post. I think this is part of the attraction for me. Like, let's have a globe-trotting vampire narrative. What do vampires look like in Africa? You know, in that folklore.
I like it. Okay, who's brave and bold next? This might be an indexing show, but it's going to jump around and is inspired by this issue we're looking at now. So every episode will explain the thematic logic between this episode's guest star and the next. So Siskoid, where to now, and how do you get us there?
All right, well, the easiest would have been probably Man-Bat. You know, there are a couple of team-ups with Man-Bat, but I didn't want to go there. I thought, well, we're going to be stuck in Batman for too long. So I propose, instead, Brave and the Bold, number 112, Batman and Mr. Miracle. The connection? I-Vampire is a Jam DeMatteis creation, so I went with another character that he left his stamp on. He wrote Mr. Miracle's Suburban Adventures in the 80s, and of course, in JLI. So 112 is the first of three team-ups for him and Batman in this series. We're going to go with that one.
Cool. And I think it's probably the first time he appeared outside of a Kirby comic, I bet. Too.
I think
just
so.
Like, just like Commandy when we covered that.
Okay, now it's time for feedback on our previous episode, Together, in which we covered Brave and the Bold, number 80, starring Batman and the Creeper.
Bucky749 wrote in and said, "Here's my team up for the Creeper. He goes on an adventure with Elvira and Vampire to face Hades and save the House of Secrets and House of Mystery from a fate worse than death. A reboot. Can the Creeper and his harem of terror save the day?" And that's appropriate because Elvira did host the House of Mystery reboot after House of Mystery was canceled. So.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Rob McCarthy here says, "The original Creeper could not be simpler. Spider-Man, if Peter Parker was old enough to tell JJJ to fuck himself."
Okay. I'd like to see Tobey Maguire do that in the movie, you know. Just tell J.K. Simmons, just tell him to F off, you know. They should have done that when he was possessed by the black suit. You know, that would have worked.
Mm.
Yeah. Dr. Ange writes in, I think the dissonance between button-down investigative reporter Jack Ryder and lunatic Creeper is really the juice for the character. I think it works even better when Ryder veers into a more conservative host and Creeper veers into more truly insane, adding even more distance between the characters. And then he continues, as for a dream team-up, what about Creeper with Marvel's Foolkiller? Maybe the whole issue, Foolkiller is eternally debating whether or not to off his partner. Yeah, that'd be a good one.
Then we have Rob Kelly says, this was a really fun discussion. You guys seem to be having a really good time. Which sort of sounds like a backhanded compliment.
Yeah, I guess guys, you're having
fun.
Time.
Always fun to podcast with Chris, I must say. Says, I had never thought it before until Chris mentioned it. But yes, Neil Adams' hyper-realistic art style and Bob Haney's goofy-ass plots were an odd mix. How does an artist make some of the characters and situations seem remotely real when Haney never really worried about any of that? On a related note, some of Adams' layouts are a little too clever for their own good, but I guess that's how you learn what works and what doesn't. I mean, the guy was experimental, you know, at a time in a medium, superhero comics, that were not particularly experimental. So I think he broke a lot of new ground that then, you know, other artists were very inspired by that. And we get, like, even in this, there's a Zipitone moment for Batman.
Yes.
in the issue we just covered. And, you know, those kinds of effects were sort of developed by Neil Adams up to a point.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and he, like we said, some of it was a little hard to follow. But, again, this is very early. So, yeah, co-sign all that. Chris Pine writes in, I felt like I was on drugs reading this book, the panel layouts, the Creeper's psychedelic colors, the weird dialogue, the cavalcade of mob guy names, Batman watching TV, the random judo chops. It was a lot. So I'm glad you both took time to discuss how weird the story and dialogue was in juxtaposition with the art and our more modern interpretations of the characters. Really, the only way for me to describe what reading this book was like would be to say, imagine Matt Reeves' The Batman was exactly the same in every way, but you replace Robert Pattinson with Adam West Batman. The Batusi done to Nirvana. Well, somebody did cut together the trailer for The Batman with Adam West in his place, and it's really funny. It's out on YouTube. I don't know who did it, but it's fun. So go find that.
Okay, I got to check that out. All right, well, that's the bottom of the mailbag, so thanks for teaming up with me, Chris. Tell people what you're working on at the moment.
We're wrapping up Season 2 coverage of Justice League Unlimited over on JLU Cast. Cindy and I are going to do a wrap party episode, then we're jumping into the final season of Justice League Unlimited, talking about Season 3, which is essentially the Super Friends season, where they're fighting more or less the Legion of Doom. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
And I'm going to be on some of those shows, so finally.
Yes. Yes.
We have some dates there. All right, a reminder that we do have a Patreon, so if you like this content and want more like it, please think about making a monthly or one-time donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Check it out at patreon.com/FW podcasts. This month, we're proud to team up with our sponsor, Alan W. Wright, the Bold Outlaw. We do enjoy reading your thoughts, of course, and that the best place for that is fireandwaterpodcast.com, and we'll read your comments on this issue when Chris is back with us. But next month, I'll be here with our friend Ryan Daly as we continue his coverage of Marvel 2-in-1 with issue 26 of that title. On that, see you next time for another amazing superhero team-up, because after all, justice
is a team effort.
And now, I'll leave you.